Hey there. You know, if you're a frequent listener to our show, you already know that our show is brought to you by our friends over at Artillery Sports. But what you may not know is that Artillery Sports helps athletes of all types win on and off the course and court. They do this by selling quality, durable, and precision manufactured sports equipment that keeps you in the game, while also using a portion of the profits to provide the funding needed to care for our nation's veterans. With Artillery Sports, it's more than just a game. So head over to artillerysports.com today to buy the quality equipment you need to keep you in the game and to help our nation's veterans at the same time. That's artillerysports.com. Make sure you head on over there today. Oh, and use the code DOCFIRST to get 10% off your first order. Welcome to Documentary First, an inside look at documentary filmmaking. I'm your host, Christian Taylor, and a documentary filmmaker myself. And today, we have something very different in store. Recently, I was a guest on a podcast called The Movie Rob Minute. It's a unique podcast done by a podcaster named Rob, who is incredibly interested in movies. He lives over in Israel. He actually is a former service member in Israel. He's an American, but long ago he moved over to Israel and he really liked it there and decided to stay. Because he's so passionate about movies, he decided to start his own podcast, and he has a very strange take on what he likes to do. He wants to review minutes. No, he doesn't. He wants to review movies minute by minute. And this is what I mean. He wanted me to be on the podcast during the D-Day era or like time of year. And he wanted me to review Saving Private Ryan minute by minute. Well, not me exactly reviewing it minute by minute, but he wanted me to be on an episode with him as we talked about 1 minute out of all of the minutes in Saving Private Ryan. It was something I had never contemplated before and didn't think I would enjoy very much, but it happened to be quite entertaining. And it was really something unique, quite frankly. And the interest was enhanced when I was able to invite one of my college best buddies, Corey Johnson, to join us. Corey, if you look him up on IMDb, is a friend, but he's also a very talented actor. And he was in the movie Saving Private Ryan, also in Band of Brothers, also in many other movies that you may recognize him in if you look him up on IMDb. Anyway, we were really excited to have Corey on the show with us. And it was great to have his insight into the characters and he knows so many people. He has so many stories. And as you will discover, he absolutely loves to talk. And, you know, he knows that himself. So he'll reference that himself many times in our conversations. Now, you may get sick of hearing us both talk because these episodes really tended to go rather long. And over the course of the next few weeks, we are going to share this with you because they are actually very interesting. John is I call him John. I'm sorry. I hoped I wouldn't do that, but his real name is John Johnson and his stage name is Corey. And so I try to call him Corey as best I can, but sometimes I slip up. Anyway, Corey is, from New Orleans, and you'll love his accent. I hope you enjoy listening to him talk and also tell all of his incredible stories. And I hope you'll get to know Rob. He is incredibly brilliant and knows so much about movies. So I hope you'll enjoy listening to this episode of Documentary First, where we believe everybody has a story to tell and you can be the one to tell it. So enjoy listening, everybody.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 131 of Season 8 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we FUBAR our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and this week I have a real treat for you guys. I have two guests that will be joining me all week. The first one is Christian Johnson Taylor, who is an actress, a filmmaker, producer. When I'm going to have her back later this season also for another special episode. So welcome, Christian.
Thank you very much. So wonderful to be here with you.
And our other guest is Corey Johnson, who is an actor. And I didn't know this at the time, but he's in this movie. You know, so we're, we're going to touch upon, you know, the stuff that he did in this movie and in some other movies also. So welcome to the show, Corey.
Thank you. It's good to be here as well. Yeah, there's no reason you should know I was in the movie unless you sort of dug through the cast list for some inane reason. I was. If you blink, you'll miss me.
You think I didn't? Of course I did.
No.
Of course I did. When back in the episodes that you or the episode you appeared in, I did discuss it, but you know, I didn't know you at the time.
No, exactly.
Now I know you. I've seen you. We've joked around a little bit. You know.
Yes. So, we've broken bread. Yes, I hear you.
He also has the wonderful pleasure of being one of my favorite college classmates. So, at Catholic University in Washington, D.C., way back when.
Way back when. That's how a while ago. Yeah.
Right. Well, that you know, through Christian is how I got to Corey. So, you know.
Right. Right. You know, so many people tell me that I only got to you through her. And
through Joe Amadei, who you've had a guest on here before, who's my distributor, is how I ended up here on your
podcast. That's right. Because Joe and I got to Joe from Steve J. Rubin.
And how is that connection?
Steve J. Rubin, well, on my first season, I did The Great Escape.
Okay.
And I found an article that Steve J. Rubin had written about it, and I contacted him. And, you know, he was able to, you know, he was really excited to be on the first season of my show and he joined me. And he actually also got me in touch with the late, great David McCollum, who I interviewed on that first season also.
Wow.
He gave me the greatest line that I never expected to get. I knew that there was one thing. I don't know if either of you know the backstory about David McCollum and you know, and everything that happened between him and Charles Bronson.
No.
No. Was it
they,
not
they
good?
Shared a wife. They shared a wife.
Wow. I met him at the Utah Beach Museum, like 2018, like the first year I was there, I think, or 19. But I did not learn that fact. That's very fascinating.
So David McCollum was married to Jill Ireland.
Oh, my
and
God.
When they, I didn't know that. And when they were filming The Great Escape, he joined him in England.
Yeah.
And during the course of that time that they were there, he also got to know Charles Bronson. And again, I don't know all the details. And
no.
I don't really care, and I don't need to know the details.
No.
Okay. But somehow, in the end, David McCollum and Jill Ireland got divorced, and then she married Charles Bronson. So I said to myself, when I'm doing this interview, that is the one topic I'm going to stay so far away from.
Clear. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't need it or anything like that.
No.
And then he brought it up.
Right.
And was it? And he said that it was his great escape.
Oh, wow. Well, that's lucky then, because I was going to say, usually like, you know, you look at, it's like the Animal House thing, Boone and Katie, married 1965, divorced 1969. You go, it's never the love story for the ages. Bronson and Jill Ireland was a love story for the ages.
That's right.
I think she died of cancer or something, and he nursed her through it. He never left her side, you know.
Wow.
And and so it's good, not good, but it's great to hear that, you know, David McCollum was sort of ambivalent about the marriage to the point where when something.
Because at that point, he had been remarried for 50 years.
Well, there you
go. To his his new wife.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so he said that he, you know, had that whole situation not happened,
he never would have never met. You see, that's it's amazing the way life works out.
Sure.
Yeah. And, you know, he also told me stories about some of the other actors in the movie at the time. You know, when I recorded with him, I think it was 4 years ago, there were only three of the actors from the movie that were still alive.
Yeah.
Wow. You know,
and he was the most prominent of the three. And, you know, he unfortunately has passed since then.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It was such a great opportunity to be able to speak to him. So, okay.
And how did he know Joe?
A little bit of a tangent.
How did he know Joe? How did he know Joe Amadei?
No, he doesn't know Joe. He knows Steve J. Rubin.
And how does
he interview him? Steve, I don't know if you know who Steve J. Rubin is.
No.
Okay, so he's like an expert on James Bond. He's written like books on James Bond. He's written books on World War II movies. He's very connected in Hollywood, from what I understand. And he's actually going to be on in a few weeks also. He's going to be on this season also. I think in maybe a little bit of about a month from now or something like that. And so Steve told me, he says, hey, if you're going to talk about somebody, if you're looking for other people for The Great Escape, he says, I got my friend Joe Amadei who named his production company after Steve McQueen's character, Virgil Hicks. You know, the company is called Virgil Production. So I got in touch with Joe and you know, he also joined me for 5 episodes. And I think it was about 2.5 years ago, I was visiting in the States and Joe and I were supposed to get together and have breakfast together one morning. And then he got in touch with me the day before and said that he has to babysit his grandchildren. So he's going to have to cancel on me. I never got to meet him face to face. And then, you know, I continued my connection to Joe. And then when I did It's a Wonderful Life for my 6th season, so he contacted me and said that he loves that movie and he wants to also be on it. And then he got me in touch with Donna Reed's daughter.
Yes, Mary Owen. Mm-hmm.
Mary mm-hmm. Owen.
That's Mary right. Owen Mary, is who introduced Mary. Me to Joe Amadei because she saw my film at a film festival, loved it, and said, Joe Amadei has to see this and distribute your film. Look at that.
There you go.
Listen, right. Let me just say, networking in Hollywood is what it's all about. It's
that's right.
Really who you know.
My That's favorite right. line, my favorite line in It's a Wonderful Life. You got to remember this is that when they go back, they're showing them in high school when they open up the swimming pool.
Yes. Love
they're
it.
Dancing mm-hmm. by the swimming pool. Yeah.
And who's the guy who opens the swimming pool?
You the, know kid who got, is? The kid who got, the one who got jilted by her.
No, but do you know who the actor is?
No.
No.
He's Alfalfa from The Little Rascal.
Well, is really? That right? He's so cute. Yeah.
Well, the guy looks at him just before he opens it. And do you remember the line he said when he says, you know, they're dancing on the thing and you know, that court is right below a swimming pool, right? And the swimming pool's right below there. And there's the switch. And you see the thing going on. But just before, and these are high school kids. There's no way you would have a line like this in a movie today. He walks over to him. The guy comes in, Alfalfa's in profile. And the other guy comes in behind him. And he's just like Iago. He goes, what's the matter, Othello? And it's just the most brilliant, literate line I've ever heard ostensibly a child, a high school kid utter. That's what's awesome. The matter, Othello?
He had a good education.
Yes, exactly. Which used to make movies like that.
What's even more interesting is for that line to land with the audience, the audience had to have.
To be literate. Exactly.
Literate. Exactly. Audience. You know? And that's what I find fascinating.
And now you get actors. We could have a whole podcast about this. Actors who are mic'd. Actors who don't have to, they don't have to talk any louder than this because they can project on a mic all the way across. And it's like, what's connected about that? It's like being an opera singer and going, oh, I'm not going to project. I'm just going to sing this tone like this. The whole point of singing opera. Yeah.
John, we're taking this in a whole different direction.
This I know. You said, you said three hours.
This is great.
Let's get on the subject. Come on. Christian's going to yell at me.
Just to give you the full quote that you mentioned. So the friend comes over and says, what's the matter, Othello? Jealous? And he goes, did you know there's a swimming pool under this floor? And did you know that that button behind you causes this floor to open up?
Open up, yeah.
And did you further know that George Bailey is dancing right over that crack? Now I've got the key.
That's just great.
How do you know that line by line?
Wait, let me guess. You looked it up on the IMDb.
No, not at all. I looked it up in my files.
There you go.
You know,
yeah.
I have the scripts
you
from,
did
you
do
know,
this
from
minute by minute. Yeah.
What's the matter, Othello? It's just the way he says it. It's so beautiful.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, God. There are some great lines, some great lines and some great moments in that movie that you really, you can't have today.
That's true.
Correct. Correct. You know, again, there's still something that I I'm always shocked every time I says it when, you know, the Mary's mother calls down and says, what are you doing down there? And she says, he's making violent love to me.
Love to me.
And again, nowadays, that's a completely different connotation.
Connotation,
than it was
exactly.
In 1946.
Exactly.
You know, because it always shocked me that that's what they're, what?
Nothing I don't want him to do, you know. Even that would get her in trouble.
Yeah, probably.
Anyway.
Probably. All right. So let's talk a little bit about Saving Private Ryan at this point.
Let's delve.
That's right. So minute 131 begins with Mike moving some rocks. And ends with Miller looking up for help from above. So we basically finished things on Friday with, you know, the men realizing that the tanks are getting closer and that they're hoping that they're going to come down this little street. And, you know, we talked a little bit about it on Friday that, you know, Tom Sizemore's character, Mike, is, you know, trying to do all that he can while he's in this ditch to you know, keep himself as hidden as possible. And he starts moving some rocks, which I just think is really funny because, you know, the whole ground is shaking. So moving a little rock here or there is probably not going to make much of a difference.
Yep. But the thing about it, was, is in that war, you would think, and how many pairs of socks can they give us? And what are we going to do with this tar, you know? And yet they made sticky bombs because these, there's a reason they were called the greatest generation. They were the most resourceful people out of necessity and from birth because, you know, somebody said, look, we want you to join the army. And they said, it's going to be hard. It's going to be, you're going to work. You're going to this. And they went, They didn't hear anything they hadn't been through. And then they said, we'll give you three squares and a cot. And they went, excuse me? They said, we'll give you three squares and a cot. Most of them had never eaten three meals a day. Some of them had never slept in a bed. And so they said that and they said, I'm in, where do I sign? Nothing anyone could do to them was going to put them off. And so this That's was right. such a resourceful group of people that, you know, I mean, that moment of him moving the rocks, Tom Hanks looking up, you know, it's just the idea that you go, he's hoping for a higher power. He's praying for a higher power. And the genius of Steven Spielberg is you never expect what ends up happening to happen. You think it's going to be a sticky bomb. You think it's going to be some slip up. Somebody's going to save the day. And you don't expect the deus ex machina, literally a deus ex machina that you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, of course.
Theater person. Of course. Right. It, you know, because it is a machine acting like a god. I mean, you know, and it just, when the planes come overhead, it's like the wave of relief that went through the audience at that moment. You could tell that people knew this was the end for these guys, you know?
Right.
You know, sure. I have a different take on the moving of the rock. So, you know, the saying, there are no atheists in boxholes. And I've talked to a lot of these guys who were, no matter where they were, trying to hide, where they're moving rocks or digging ditches deeper or putting, you know, branches over their foxhole, because they will actually admit now at 98 or 100 years old that of course we were scared.
They were terrified.
Of course we were terrified. We'd be stupid to think we were not scared.
Right.
Well, if they you know, weren't scared, then most of them wouldn't have had a problem talking about it afterwards. You know, that's part of the reason probably why most of them kept it bottled up, because they didn't want to show everyone that, you know, that they were actually in a situation where they were scared.
Terrified for their lives. Yeah. Reliving. Well, you don't want to relive that. You want to forget that.
Yeah.
You
know? Correct.
I mean, and the reason, let me just say that I know the things. I mean, I'm here because the film that I made, it's called The Girl Who Wore Freedom, and it's the story of D-Day, but from the perspective of the French. And I started working on that film back in 2016. So it's now 2025. I've been, you know, working on this film for 9 years now. I continue to talk and work with World War II veterans as well as currently serving soldiers. And so I have a unique perspective on, you know, this film simply because I've spent so much time with these guys. And, you know, one of the reasons that I've heard that they don't talk about things as well is two reasons. One, they've told me when they try, people don't want to listen. Their eyes glaze over and they don't really seem that interested.
I find that so shocking, because if someone were to tell me these stories, I would love to hear them.
Yeah, but you have to understand that the wars we've grown up with aren't absolute. They're wars of choice.
Correct.
You know, this was an either or situation. You know, the World War II and World War One. I mean, World War One, basically, they called it the war to end all wars. They used to call it the Great War.
The Great War, exactly.
Before we had to number them, do you know? And the only reason, I mean, this is what's dangerous about the time we're living in, is one of the only reasons we haven't had another war is because of things like the United Nations and the Marshall Plan and deterrent, right. But, you know, this was an absolute. This war was either we win or we lose. It wasn't, well, we can sort of back out and there'll be honor in this and, you know, we'll let them go. And it wasn't that. There was no intent. Germany and Japan had no intention of losing. They had no intent. They were in it for, you know, absolute. Everybody was all in on this poker hand.
That's right.
So, yeah, it wasn't, you don't see like what happened in Afghanistan, what happened in Vietnam, even to a degree what happened in Kuwait. I mean, that was an overwhelming military firepower that completely destroyed another country. And yet we still said, okay, all right, you can have this and you can keep those and you can do this, because it was as important to keep that country in with a semblance of governance instead of going in and, you know, it's like the Pottery Barn, you break it, you bought it. Instead of going in and governing that country ourselves, that wasn't what, especially at the time, but that wasn't what we were supposed to be about. But in World War II, we entered that war because freedom and democracy, freedom first, but democracy to a degree, the freedom for people to choose the way they live their lives had to be saved, you know?
And well, so, and not only that, we were all on the same page with that idea.
Yeah. There were no separate agendas.
There was no, I mean, everybody, it was very simple. It was black and white. Right. It was, we were all on the same page, not just, you know, the Americans, but the Americans and all the allies. And there was one single objective and we were all on the same page. And ever since World War II, that has been different. Now, to address what you were saying, that it's hard to imagine that people don't want to listen. That's because you are in a very niche audience. And the people that are listening to this, probably in that very niche audience. And I have the people that watch my film, niche audience, you know?
The other thing, Christian, is your movie, your documentary is telling a story that I believe at first Americans don't feel like they need to hear. And then it's only when you listen to it and you go, God, this is amazing. I didn't know this, you know?
We think we're thankful.
That's what I felt. When I saw your movie, that's what I thought. I said to myself, I never even thought to even, you know,
consider that.
It never even crossed my mind to consider the fact that the French people would, you know, 80 years on still be so happy about the fact that, you know, that the Allies showed up. I mean, again, anyone who's seen Band of Brothers, you know they have all the parades both in, you know, in Holland and also in France when they're going through there and all that stuff. But that's at the moment. You know, but here we're talking 80 years later, it still resonates. And that's just, wow.
Yeah.
So for those of you that are listening, my film, The Girl Who Wore Freedom, you can find out information about that on thegirlwhowarefreedom.com. There's a 4-minute trailer right when you get there and you can click on it. It's actually John's voice, who's the narrator there. He was the very first person that I called when I had the idea to make the film. You know, like I said, we've known each other since college and, you know, I knew he had this history with World War II films. He's a phenomenal narrator and an actor. And, you know, of course, he had this connection to Tom Hanks. And I was hoping that there would be some way I could connect or have support or whatever. But mostly I wanted to know, do you think this is a good idea? And in the end, what the crux of this story is that, you know, the French have this way of being truly grateful and showing their gratitude that's completely different than anything that Americans have ever done.
And grateful and gracious, because there's nothing diminutive about them being this grateful. It's a celebration of their gratefulness, which is, you know, a tribute to their culture.
And it's not just the French, however. I've learned it's also the people in Luxembourg, and it's also the people in Holland. It's the people in, you know, Belgium. It's it's the people in the Netherlands. I have traveled all over and it is the same, because when you have been oppressed for that long, it's 4 years. Most people don't know their history enough to know that it was four years. It's like the high school or college. When you've been oppressed that long and under that thumb, and all of a sudden you're liberated from that, that gratitude is so deep. We've never been occupied in the US. So we do not know that kind of. So when I saw that gratitude for freedom that had been passed down from, you know, parents to children and or grandparents to grandchildren, I was stunned. And I thought we have to look through the French eyes and we have to understand what true gratitude really looks like. And what I learned was as they listened to the veterans, and as they spent time with the veterans, I watched it change the veterans. I watched it be like the fountain of youth for them. They started out the trip, you know, old and kind of, you know, I don't know, rickety. But by the time they were done, they were they were dancing. They were happy.
Yeah.
Because people for sure. And it makes sense.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is people don't listen. And so that's why veterans didn't share. And the other reason that they don't share is because it is so traumatic that to repeat or share any of that stuff is so incredibly painful. And so now today, you know, we are learning that by talking, it is the healing, and that's the way to heal PTSD. But back then, nobody knew that. And so everything was stuffed down. And so
it's the American way as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you just sort of held it in.
Have you, either of you seen the movie Memorial Day from 2012?
No.
With James, I remember his name right now.
Woods?
No, I said James. No.
I'm just guessing. What other Jameses are in there? Franco, Woods.
No. Take in a second.
Marston. That's
where editing comes in here later. James Cromwell. Okay.
James Cromwell.
So it's a movie about it takes place in numerous timelines, right? It's about this this soldier fighting in Iraq, who is remembering a day. I don't know, 10 years earlier, where he was at his grandparents' farm, and he found a chest filled with World War II memorabilia when this kid was 13. And so he wants to hear the stories from his grandfather as to what happened during World War II. So the grandfather is played by James Cromwell. And so basically, I'm not going to give away the entire movie, but the idea is that the grandfather says, it's too painful, but I'm willing to tell you three stories. Hey, pick three items from the chest, and I will tell you their stories. And again, it's just amazing because we see stuff that happened in World War II. We see stuff that's happening in Iraq. You know, we see this connection between a grandfather and a 13-year-old kid. You know, about the whole idea of, you know, having to find ways to open up and tell your story. You know, you might want to hold it in, but if you hold it in for too long, you're not going to be able to pass on those stories so that people won't know what you went through.
Right.
So I actually just rewatched it yesterday because, you know, after talking to you the other day, Christian, it reminded me that I wanted to rewatch that movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I tell you, it is really important. And if there are any veterans listening to this podcast, I say this all the time. It is crucially important that if you have served and you have never shared your story, even if you've never been in actual combat, it is really important that you share your story, particularly with your family. And the reasons are that civilians don't understand anything about the military. They don't understand the questions to ask you, but they do want to know. They genuinely want to know. But they don't understand anything about the military. So where do they start? And the thing is, once you begin to share, it draws you closer. And if you have been in combat, it does begin to heal. And it does pass down the stories to those that are younger than you. So, you know, please do share your stories. Learn from this conversation and don't hold them in.
Yeah, for sure. That's great. All right, let's continue talking about Saving Private Ryan.
Yes, let's do. Okay, so he's moving the rock.
You know what? You know what, I'm gonna divert a little bit also, because Corey, you were in this movie, so let's, you know, through the course of this week, maybe we'll talk each day a little bit about, you know, your experiences when you made this movie. But the first question is how did you you know, how did you get the part?
Remember, like the same way I got everything else. It was sheer unmitigated luck. No, one of my professors at college said there are three things that make an actor: talent, luck, and perseverance. And the interesting thing he said was any two and you can make it. But if you've only got one, you won't make it. I always thought I was reasonably talented. And it was just luck that I was in the right place at the right time when they were casting it, because, you know, they obviously, a lot of things were cast in Los Angeles. And in the 70s and 80s, they used to come over here and cast.
Wait a second. You can't just say come over here. John is living in London.
London.
After college, he decided to go to RADA, which is the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts.
No, I went to Central.
Central Academy of Dramatic Arts.
Speech and drama. Yeah.
And he's lived there ever since. So that's where he is. Right. And by the way, he said he thought he was reasonably talented. He's one of the most talented actors I've ever met. He's phenomenal. And so let's just set that record straight.
So anyway, I was lucky and I persevered, because the lack of talent was palpable in my, I just happened to be in the right place at the right time when they were casting, some of the smaller roles. And, I think, you know, I'm a big believer in, luck, in the sense of people always think, look, you know, if it weren't for bad luck, I'd have no luck at all. Luck is luck. You determine that it's bad luck, you know, but it's like, you know, God closes a door, he opens a window. There's always something else going on. It's up to you to be able to see it. And sometimes we're so mired in what we think we want to be or what we think we need that it's difficult to see what it is we're being offered. I never had that problem. Being an American over here, I was always grateful to sort of be working. And it's not like I did a lot of work, but I did enough work to where I could live a reasonably, you know, happy life. But anyway, I was offered a very small part in Saving Private Ryan, and I was booked for a couple of weeks.
And now, didn't they film it over in London?
In Ireland.
And so did they cast the leading roles in LA and then? And then the smaller roles they cast in over there.
You know, that's what I was saying. They, in the 70s and 80s,
they used
to come over here with, I mean, there were all kinds of movies that came over here. Yanks, John Schlesinger's movie, came over here after Richard Gere. And it came over here and he filled out some of the smaller roles. It's like a who's who of American Canadian actors in London. They'd film in London, they'd film in France, because it was cheaper to do that than to film in America. And then gradually London and Europe became expensive, and so they moved to Eastern Europe. And, you know, Czechoslovakia, Poland, even Germany. I shot a movie in Germany in 92 that took place during the Cold War. So I just happened to be in the right place at the right time, and I got cast in this movie. I'm pretty sure I auditioned for one of the main characters, and just it didn't work out. So I was offered this one. Now, we were there for a couple of weeks. I remember we flew in on a Saturday into Dublin and then drove two hours and change to Rosslare Harbor, where it was being filmed. And our, as I remember, our bed and breakfast was sort of within 5 or 10 minutes walk of where the set was. And you could go and look and see. They would have these huge, what are they called, Christian? The tank busters, where they'd have the huge
steel, a hedgehog.
They have these huge steel things.
The Czech hedgehogs.
And they, you'd look at them, and it'd be like, at the end of the day, it was like, wow, that just looks amazing. And the sea is washing in. And then this runner would go up and stand under one, lift it up, and walk it up the beach. And you think, okay, that's just another illusion shattered. But I had a costume fitted or something, and you show up on Monday, and or I don't know if we showed up on Monday, but what happened was, is someone called our hotel and said, yeah, we're not going to get to you guys today. I was like, okay. And but tomorrow we'll get you in and we'll sort of talk you through some stuff. So tomorrow we went in and again, you know, we were there for like a few hours in the morning. We met a few people. I remember not meeting, but I saw Tom Sizemore, and he was sitting like in his trailer or something. And I just went up to him and I said, "Hey, Tom, I'm Corey. I've got a small part in the movie. I just wanted to say hi and introduce myself." And he, like, because Tom Sizemore was not sort of, you know, the easiest person to sort of approach. He's a very intense man. And he just kind of looked at me like, "I don't know you. Why are you standing in front of me?" And he went, "Uh-huh." And I just left. And I remember like, okay. But all of these guys.
He doesn't seem like that. You know,
he does.
Well,
he does.
I'll tell you another story about it.
He was given an ultimatum by Spielberg about this movie.
Well, he was told he was going to have to submit urine tests.
That's right.
To make sure.
Wait, I haven't heard this.
And if he fails them, any of them, they're gonna recast his role and reshoot every one of the scenes.
They were gonna recast him. Yeah.
So he did drugs. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah, yes. He was notorious that I want to say it was Heat, but I don't believe he did another movie with Robert De Niro. Robert De Niro really rated him as an actor. He thought he was great. And Robert De Niro was friendly with his family. He knew his mother. And Tom was brought up in Detroit, I believe, and one of his brothers, I want to say, died in Vietnam. Hmm. I could be wrong, but he had sort of a rough childhood. And was, you know, I mean, self-anesthetizing. And his mother was very worried and called Robert De Niro and said, "You've got to help him." And so they intervened. Robert De Niro and his own mother said, "You've got to get help," and got him clean for a period of time. And this was right around Private Ryan. I think it was after Heat. It may have been before Heat.
He came out in 95.
Right. It may have been before Heat, but I think it was after Heat. And then he was clean for Private Ryan. Now, by the time I did another movie that was awful in 2002, right around the time Tom was shooting Relic, and he was determined that he could do this movie, and he had like scraggly hair and a full beard when he was doing Relic, and he said, no, I can do it. I'll just shave the beard off. And they said, "You've got them." He said, "They'll put a fake beard on, a wig." And it was like, dude, no, you know, you can't. And so there was an idea that maybe, you know, he's not sort of living in the real world. You know, now I saw him years ago at a Comic-Con, and he was giving a speech. He was talking to people, and he was very forthcoming because he had had the whole Heidi Fleiss thing and he had gone to prison. And he told a story about being in prison. He said, "All these guys who were my friends, none of them came to visit me in prison, except for Tom Hardy."
Interesting.
Tom Hardy. Tom Hardy is one of the, I'm probably going to ruin his reputation. And if he ever sees me, he'll punch me hard in the face. One of the nicest, sweetest guys, really. He's just a lovely man. And very, he deserves what he's getting because he's been through a lot. And again, very, very, very talented, very focused, very single-minded on what he does, but didn't let his, whatever his demons were that were pursuing him, he did not let them get him, you know, which is, I mean, it's an ongoing, it's a struggle. The struggle is real. But anyway.
Anyway, so you're saying this Spielberg.
Tuesday, we show up and we meet a few people, a sit time, and then at lunch, they go home. We're not going to get to you today. Wednesday, same thing. And we used to go back to this bed and breakfast we were staying in. And they would literally say to us for dinner, we'd have 10 or 12 of us sitting around this table. And they'd go, "What do you have?" And it was like, "Well, what have you got?" "Well, we've got fish, we've got a lovely salmon, and we've got chicken, and there's some steak, lovely Irish beef." We say, "Yeah, we're all American. You know? I'll have a steak, 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 steak." By the end of the week, we just didn't call it dinner. We called it our beefing because it was just, no one was ordering fish or chicken. We were getting this Irish steak. It was sirloin. It was gorgeous. So, you know, I could have put on 20, 30 pounds just by having dinner at this place. Fortunately, Friday rolled around, Thursday rolled around, and they said, "Look, we're definitely going to get to you tomorrow. With any luck, we're going to shoot you out tomorrow." And I was booked for 2 weeks. I was going, you know, I'm here next week. They said, "Well, we'll see what happens." So sure enough, we start the sequence where the ships land on the beach and all these guys come running forward and machine guns, squibs are going off and bombs are going off. And I can remember looking at this sequence and thinking, you got to be kidding me. There were like Irish Army regulars who were running along the beach who knew what they were doing. There were amputees who were like carrying fake arms and looking around. And I was just like, this is just madness. It's chaos. And I could sit there and laugh about it, but that was exactly what he wanted to capture. And he did brilliantly, you know? He
did absolutely brilliantly. So how much would you say when you saw the film was what you saw on the beach versus CGI that was done?
As far as I know, there was very little CGI. CGI in the terms of you might have tweaked the sound. CGI in terms of I can't speak to whether or not the blood was fake. I know that 99 times out of 100, when you see someone bleeding in a movie today, it's probably fake.
Right.
Okay. So I can't speak to the CGI. I do remember, this could have been Thursday, I'm not certain, they had tramps buried in the sand. And these soldiers would run over the tramps, and as they ran over them, they would trip something that would flip the tramp, and they would be flung into the air. But they had to know how to trip the tramp. And one of these guys, either someone tripped it and he didn't step on it, he was just off it, and this tramp came up and literally broke his leg.
Oh.
And so they're going like, the guy's screaming on the beach. There are people standing around him. There's an ambulance.
That's perfect. That's what we want.
There's an ambulance driving up the beach. And then this AD pulls out a megaphone and goes, okay, people, that's lunch. And I was just like, get me off this beach, man. This is just, but you see, that's the beauty of it is even that gave me an understanding of the absolute chaos of what that must have been. And we had this in United 93. The fact that those guys couldn't leave. They couldn't go, just give it, hang on, we're going to have some lunch. Just give us a minute. Give us a minute. When they were in it, they were in it, you know? And some of them, the ones who didn't die, it was hours, like a day or 2 days before they could go and look up and catch their breath and go, okay, that's behind us. Where do we go now?
That's right. You know? What's our next objective?
What's our next play? Where are we going?
Well, you know? And let me tell you this. When some of them came off, and even the ones that came off, you know, day two, day three, they came off and they walked right into the graves. And they moved those, you know, not long after they realized we can't have these temporary graves here at the beachhead. Right. And so they did move them to St. Mary Glees. But I mean, for a while, these guys were walking off the beach straight into these temporary graves. Right. I mean,
horrific. Oh, it's horrific. It must have been horrific.
So your part playing the radio man. You didn't have to run across the beach.
No. I was discovered. I was discovered I was.
Meaning it's not that we're going to find, if you go through a fine tooth pin, you know, through the movie, we're not going to be able to find Corey Johnson running across the beach.
No, you won't. That's what I'm saying. They came to me because Tom Hanks's brief was you have to get to the beach. You have to what did he say? You have to report the condition is. In other words, they're going to be landing somewhere. We're going to blow this thing open and we're going to roll the ships in. And so that's what you mentioned, a scene when Tom Sizemore's helmet flips off.
Mm-hmm.
I remember watching them shoot that scene.
Oh wow!
And I remember. I was standing just behind the camera and I remember going, that probably wasn't a good take. And then Spielberg just really calmly said, okay, nice. He said, Tom, remember when you do such and such and this and that, and keep your voice going because there's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of noise. Okay. And let's just do one more. And he does one more and it's absolutely flawless. And he says, okay, great. We got it. That was his security. he knew the one with the helmet coming off was the one he was going to use. I believe that. I believe he saw that and he didn't want to say anything because a shot like that is a miracle. You have to understand, when something like that happens, occurs, and you manage to get it on film and it's in focus, you go, please, God, please, God, please, please let there not be a hair in the gate. Please let it be in focus. Please, all this. But you have to still go, let's get one more for security in case it doesn't work.
Yeah, because you never know. You can look out, you know, that's the thing I learned as a director. You can look at what's happening with the actors and outside of the camera.
Uh-huh.
And everybody's acting and all of the things you see outside of the camera can be flawless.
Perfect. Right.
And then something with the audio or something with, you know, a hair in the camera or something.
Or a bird craps on someone's shoulder.
Something like that. And you get in post and you're like, oh my gosh, it ruined that perfect take.
And I don't have anything else.
And I don't have a backup. Yeah. You always have to shoot it again. Yeah.
And that you see, this is the brilliant thing about Steven Spielberg. I think I've worked with him once. So, you know, and I didn't get to chat with him much. I just got to say hello a little bit, but watching him work, you realize he knows what he's going to do. He knows what he wants to do. He doesn't have to tell anyone, this is what I know. He just gets people who do their jobs. And when he says, there were sometimes half a dozen cameras running at the same time on this beach. You know, there were handheld cameras. There were all different kinds of cameras. You know, all of them, Janusz who shot it. Scrubbed lenses, you know, really, really stark, no coatings, no, just scrubbed lenses and looking as raw as possible, looking as much like a cinematic version of a human eye, nothing protected, nothing kind of, there was nothing, you know, when they put a coating on a lens, it gives you the luxury of being able to go and sit back. This, when you watch Private Ryan, you're going, it's like you watch it with a little bit of horror. You know, not like you watched Apocalypse Now.
Or a lot of horror when if you're
something like Beast. But well the thing about it is there were so many other things
at play. Right there.
Yeah.
There were so many other things at play with that movie. I watched the first sequence, Private Ryan came out when we were in I believe we were in Morocco shooting The Mummy. We may have just been back. I think we were just back. We were in London. It was like July 98. And it must have either just come out or something, June 98, the producers got a copy of it, and we watched it, and I'm sitting with a guy who is a South African actor who was wounded in, you know, a war in South Africa, and literally watched the first bit of that movie like, this is a big guy, watched the first bit of that movie like this. And I didn't know if he was praying or just couldn't watch it, but he couldn't talk about it. Didn't come out going, man, that was realistic. Man, that was this. He just went and just, it was like, it was too much. It was too much. It's amazing for a man who, I mean, I don't know how he knows war, who never didn't serve, didn't, you know, wasn't really come close to it, but had no fear, no trepidation about asking what would be really hard questions about something and literally saying, I am not a guy who knows. I am a guy who wants to know what you know. I want to tell this story. I believe this. I want to tell this story. I need to tell your story, and I need you to tell it to me so I can tell it to people, you know?
Well, and I've learned a lot of veterans say about Saving Private Ryan when they went the first time that it was that movie that got them to start talking, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't understand that, but John, listen, you've been like going off on a tangent, so I'm going to pull you right back on.
Please keep doing that.
And
is my middle name.
I know. I just want you to answer the question really simply. And then we need to move on to the next minute.
Right.
So when you had your time, your moment in the sun, you basically were just sitting on a beach. They put you on a beach. Tell me exactly what you had to do when it was your time to shoot. I want to know from the beginning to the end, what was your day of shooting like? Did it take 1 day, 2 days? Like, give me what you had to do, please. Well, as you can tell, we went down a lot of rabbit holes in this episode. There was so much to cover, so much to unpack in the making of Saving Private Ryan. And with Corey's incredible experiences, well, we just couldn't stop talking. So as you heard at the very end there, I asked him a really interesting question. And if you want to hear his answer, you're going to have to join us for the next episode to hear his full answer to my question and catch the rest of our conversation about this pivotal moment in the film. Thank you so much for listening to Documentary First, where we believe everybody has a story to tell and you can be the one to tell it. Bye, everybody. Thank you for listening to Documentary First. We really appreciate your partnership with us. We can't do any of this without you. So thank you for listening, donating, and following along on our journey. We are supported by generous donations from people just like you. To make a donation, visit thegirlwhowarefreedom.com or support us on Patreon at patreon.com/documentaryfirst. To learn more about our other works in progress, visit documentaryfirst.com or follow Documentary First on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. This podcast was produced by Documentary First, edited and mixed by Jason Hoban, with music by Jeff Kurtenacker.